The North Carolina Reading Service presents this program for blind and print-impaired listeners. And it's the weekly broadcast of the Indie Week, and I'm John Feddersen here to read it for you. An abbreviated introduction because we have a very thick folder of articles to get at you from Indie Week today. I'll be lead off from Durham and the Durham Public Schools. A week ago, Wednesday, DPS closed 12 schools. Educators called out of work to attend protests. Educators and staff plan to attend protests, including a Durham Association of Educators DAE protest. A release from the President Simone Kidu sent Tuesday evening states the protest is scheduled to take place at the DPS Fuller Building on Cleveland Street from 2 to 4 p.m. in Durham. Another protest is planned for 10 a.m. at the Staff Development Center at Hillendale Road. It's not clear what percent of staff was taking part in the protest, but the prospect of the number being high raised questions about whether staffing will be adequate to safely supervise students. These protests follow an error that led to more than 1,300 classified staff being informed earlier this month that they will not continue to receive raises they had been promised in writing last year and that had already been paid for several months. Affected employees included physical and occupational therapists, instructional assistants, nutritionists, and facilities and transportation staff at schools across the district. The district has hired an outside consultant to investigate what happened, in addition to its own attorneys who are looking into the matter. DAE is a local affiliate of the North Carolina Association of Educators and the National Education Association, the largest teachers' union in the country. The group's statement says its members have asked the district to not introduce pay cuts, to reverse a policy that would erase years of work experience outside the district that count towards salary steps, and to commit to holding regular meetings with group members, quote, to discuss how to create excellent working conditions and, most of all, the learning conditions that our students deserve. Kidu wrote that DPS was right in initially increasing salaries for long underpaid staff, but said that trust has been broken now that the administration is backtracking. Kidu wrote, there are a lot of employment options in Durham and our schools and need to offer competitive salaries. We only want the best working with our students, and you have to pay to attract quality people. We all want our kids to go to schools with the best educators, best staff, and all the resources our kids need to be successful. The event on Wednesday is what's known as a sick-out, a protest tactic designed to draw attention to what DAE describes as, quote, a recruitment and retention crisis that will only get worse, unquote, if DPS doesn't find a way to pay the salaries it promised its staff, according to the letter. At a meeting last week, DPS officials promised classified workers they wouldn't have to pay back any money they've already received, and they'll be paid their promised higher salaries through January, but it's unclear what will happen after that. And DPS's former chief financial officer, Paul Nasser, who had 13 years of experience with the district, submitted his resignation last Friday. Sierra Ojijo, DPS Senior Executive Director of Financial Services, will serve as interim CFO beginning just last January the 31st. That was yesterday. And the second article is more of the same, and it concerns the Thursday evening, last Thursday evening's Board of Education meeting, which at that point classified workers won't have to pay back those wages. They were overpaid recently. Board members voted unanimously to approve $4.5 million to cover those overpayments to classified staff that appeared on the October, November, and December paychecks last year. The special allocation will also cover workers' January checks. And that vote followed a raucous rally at 5:30 p.m. as the board met in closed session. Hundreds of teachers, staff, students, and community members gathered outside the Development Center to voice their concerns about the recent changes and wages. An accounting error in a compensation study led to the overpayment of about 1,300 classified staff members in these paychecks. Employees who were given those raises, including, as the ones I mentioned before, were notified about the error and informed that years of experience outside the state or in the private sector would no longer be factored into pay. And the pay dispute resulted in a walkout by many DPS bus drivers last week. At the rally, Nakia Watson, a cafeteria staff member and DAE member, shared her experience working in Durham after in Delaware. "What we're making now," she said, "is what I was making in 2015 back home." The rain picked up. The audience huddled closer together under a canopy of umbrellas. As the board meeting began, rally participants packed into the Development Center, filling the boardroom to capacity. Friends and strangers gathered around cell phones as they streamed the meeting from the hallway. "Fire up and fire him," participants chanted from the hallway. "DPS lied," they continued. Dozens of speakers criticized the board for the error. And I've included most of those comments already. And again, Paul Lesueur, the chief financial officer, submitted his resignation, which was accepted by Superintendent Pascal Mubenga today. A story originally published on the Ninth Street Journal is now repeated in Indy Week. A case is dismissed against a J.J. Henderson resident accused of arson after burning a bagel. Pearly Williams, 63, was supposed to appear at Durham County Courthouse for her final eviction hearing on December 13th. Then 2 days beforehand, it was postponed again. The Saturday after, she messaged Ninth Street Journal in all caps, "I might have some good news to share when Attorney Smith calls me next week. Talk to you soon." And on Tuesday, December 19th, her lawyer, Ernest Smith, called to tell Williams the courts had dismissed her case. The judgment came more than 2 months after her arson charges were dismissed. Williams said, "When I won the arson case, I knew it was over, but I'm still feeling a bit antsy. It'll be a minute before I really get over this." For Williams, the phone call brought closure to a seven-month saga. Last May, Williams, who has lived at J.J. Henderson's senior apartments for over 7 years, burned a bagel in her kitchen. Days later, she was charged with arson. California Commercial Investment Companies, which manages J.J. Henderson, posted an eviction notice on her door, giving her 5 days to vacate. Williams said that CCI's action directly resulted from her complaints against the company. Last winter, Williams was quoted in articles published by Ninth Street Journal and IndyWeek criticizing management's response to a late December blackout in the building. Williams, who is partially blind from cataracts and glaucoma, spent the summer trekking to and from the courthouse with her walker for a series of continued court dates. She reported that a car almost hit her twice. After receiving news of the dismissal, she gushed over the thought of paying January's rent to the management office instead of walking half a mile to the courthouse to be billed. Quote, "I pray everyone learns something valuable from this situation. You can't just accuse people like this. You have to take extra care when investigating people who are elder and have visual disabilities." Williams also expressed worries over the terms of the dismissal. According to court records, the plaintiff, J.J. Henderson, T.C. Senior Apartments, L.P., voluntarily dismissed the complex complaint without prejudice, meaning they can bring the matter back to court. Cases are dismissed without prejudice for a number of reasons, including insufficient evidence, procedural errors, and strategy. Williams' lawyer, Ernest Smith, said that though J.J. Henderson can pursue the complaint in the future, it doesn't necessarily mean they will. He added he has no knowledge that they plan to refile the case. Smith, who specializes in civil rights law, went on, when institutions and organizations know they're dealing with people who don't have means or resources, they will do things to push an agenda. But it makes a difference when disadvantaged people have someone in their corner to fight for them. A representative of CCI declined to comment, saying, we do not comment on individual cases for privacy reasons. In the coming months, Williams plans to look for suitable housing outside of CCI's rule. She said, it's a bit worrisome. It's like a gnat in my ear. It's like they're telling me we can get you if we want to. It's really nothing, but it's something. For now, Williams said she'll celebrate by enjoying a can of ginger ale in a home that is officially hers again. She said, I just want to sit here, drink my ginger ale, and tell God thank you. I'm going to be just fine. They know not to mess with me. I have a lot of people behind me. And follow-up on an article about Millennia, property owners Millennia Housing Development. On Friday, January 19th, 14 tenants at North Durham's JFK Tower signed on to a class action lawsuit against property owner Millennia Housing. As the Indy had reported, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, recently barred Millennia from entering into any new contracts with federal agencies. JFK Towers is designed for disabled and elderly residents with all 177 units set aside for affordable housing. Local news outlets covered troubles at JFK last summer. McGinnis Howard's Class Action Division and Duke Law's Civil Justice Law Clinic filed the complaint. Tenants say many of the same problems they raised in the summer remain. Resident Jonetta Alston said on Monday, January 15th, we had all three elevators down. They've got the two passenger elevators fixed now, but Millennia's contractors are using them like a freight elevator, so they're going to break again. We've got trash chutes overflowing on all seven floors. The recurrently broken elevators are especially concerning in this seven-story apartment complex where many of the residents have mobility issues and are unable to use the stairs. The lawsuit and prior news articles mention instances of elderly, mobility-impaired residents being stuck on their floors. Alongside elevator issues, the lawsuit alleges, quote, frequent termination of residents' water supply without notice or alternate water supply, insect infestation, inadequate pest treatment, unsafe, unsanitary apartments and common areas, neglected waste management throughout the complex, unauthorized excessive late fees charged, general lack of property maintenance and response to complaints, and the dangerous disregard for fire safety and building security. A 46-page lawsuit seeks relief for tenants from Millennia on the grounds of breach of warranty of habitability. They've continued to charge market value for uninhabitable property, unfair deceptive trade practices, negligence, North Carolina Debt Collection Act, stating they charged illegally high late fees and attempted to collect on them, breach of contract, they consistently failed to fulfill their obligations as landlords, unjust enrichment, they have financially benefited from charging these excessive fees. An attorney at McGinnis Howard, Ian Vance, says the suit seeks to bring accountability to Millennia and justice for the tower's residents. He says, we understand these are only the first steps on the road to redress, but we are adamant in the pursuit of holding Millennia accountable for the substandard conditions at JFK. Providing safe and healthy living to the elderly and disabled should not take a drawn-out legal battle, but that is what we are prepared to handle. Millennia is no stranger to litigation. with class action lawsuits currently on file against the company in Georgia, Arkansas, and Tennessee. Yet more Durham Housing articles. City of Durham sues Durham Housing Authority twice in the past year over alleged disability-based discrimination. The City of Durham has sued DHA twice in last year for alleged violations of the city's Fair Housing Ordinance. Both cases, one filed on March 28th of 2023 and the other this just past January the 22nd, alleged disability-based discrimination against tenants. Both suits are related to requests for disability accommodations. And according to Neighborhood Improvement Services Department, NIS, Human Resource Manager Philip Jordan, they reflect a pattern of complaints his department has seen at DHA properties. Jordan said, quote, "One of the things that NIS are required to do is conduct investigations into allegations of housing discrimination. Over the past few years, there seems to be a pattern with DHA. Most of the complaints we get from individuals participating in a program that's administered by DHA would fall under the category of disability protected class." The March 2023 case stems from a McDougald Terrace resident who originally requested to be relocated from McDougald to a different DHA property on May 28th in 2020. With a transfer and diagnostic document from health providers citing mental disabilities, including schizoaffective disorder and PTSD. The lawsuit alleges that DHA's internal guidelines gave the agency 10 days to respond to all reasonable accommodation requests, but DHA took 13 months to respond. When they did respond on June 30th of 2021, it requested additional documentation. The McDougal Terrace responded on July 9th of 2021 and didn't hear back from DHA for another 11 months. As of right now, the tenant is still living at McDougal Terrace. A Durham Human Relations Commission report from October 2021 found illegal discriminatory practices in the case. In that January case, Cynthia Alston Cash, a former resident of Damar Court Apartments, who now resides in J.J. Henderson Senior Apartments, has an above-the-knee amputation and uses a wheelchair. Alston Cash lived at Damar Court in a two-bedroom accessible apartment starting August 15th of 2015. DHA moved Alston Cash to a one-bedroom unit at J.J. Henderson on December 13th in 2017, and the lawsuit alleges that Alston Cash was not asked for input during the move, that the new unit is handicapped inaccessible, and that Alston Cash has had to rent a storage unit for the past 6 years to hold additional belongings. It alleges, while residing at J.J. Henderson, Alston Cash has submitted a total of 5 requests for reasonable accommodation, all with documentation, between 2019 and 2021. DHA ignored 3 requests, states the lawsuit, and denied the final request, stating J.J. Henderson does not have a 2-bedroom unit. As of right now, Alston Cash is still living at Henderson. A Durham Human Relations Commission report from 2021 found illegal discriminatory practices in Alston Cash's case. She said, "They got so many letters from my doctors saying I needed to be put back where I was at because I need space. They said they was going to move me back, and they never did. That didn't happen. I'm way up here on the 8th floor. If a fire breaks out, what am I going to do?" In both cases, the City of Durham's lawsuit alleges that DHA was aware of the resident's disability, that a transfer was necessary, and that other residents in similar situations have been treated differently than Alston Cash and the other resident. The lawsuit also alleges DHA failed to respond within the appropriate time window and that the continual delay in response to requests amounted to a denial of accommodation. According to city attorney Sophia Hernandez, in the Alston Cash case, after five attempts at conciliation with DHA, the city had no choice but to turn to litigation to resolve the dispute. Indy contacted DHA communications manager Elias Sanders and chief executive officer Anthony Scott for comment. Sanders referred the Indy to Banks Law Firm for official comment. And Ted Edwards, principal of Banks Law Firm, said, "Unfortunately, due to the professional constraints governing lawyers in North Carolina, we do not comment on pending litigation." Hernandez wants residents of Durham facing adverse housing conditions or potential discrimination to know that the city is prepared to investigate and encourages residents to voice their complaints. Hernandez said, "We don't pick and choose cases. We're complaint-driven, and we're going to investigate the complaints that come to us. I want landlords to know, and I want the public to know that the city is here for that protection." Next, also more or less from Durham, it's about the committee has been named to find the next chancellor of NC Central. UNC System President Peter Hans named a committee to find that next chancellor on Friday. He said, "We have a distinguished group that will be committed to finding the best leader for North Carolina Central, and I'm excited about the future of this great university." The chairman of the search committee will be James Johnson, Jr., an alumnus of Central. Johnson's also a professor at UNC Chapel Hill's Keenan Flagler Business School and director of the Urban Investment Strategy Center. He also sits on the Governor's Environmental Justice Advisory Council. Earlier this month, NC Central Chancellor Johnson Akinleye announced he would leave the university's top leadership position at the end of the academic year. His last day is June 30th. Akinleye has been at the helm of Central, one of the UNC system's historically black colleges and universities, HBCUs, since 2017. Over that time, the Durham campus, its student body, and mission have grown. Chancellor searches are currently underway at three universities, NCANT University, Winston-Salem State University, and UNC Chapel Hill, under a recently revamped process. ATN Chancellor Harold Martin announced he would step down last September, and the search for ANT's next chancellor is already underway. Winston-Salem State's Elwood Robinson retired in June of last year, and, of course, Kevin Guskowitz, Chapel Hill, announced his move to Michigan State University last month. Chapel Hill is the first and flagship campus in the UNC system. NCANT is the largest HBCU in the nation, while Winston-Salem State is one of the smaller institutions in the system. The chancellor searches are now being held under a new process. Under the previous and somewhat controversial process, the system president was granted more direct power in the selection. That's something for which Hans pushed even before he officially assumed the presidency in 2020. Traditionally, a search committee made up of an individual's school board of trustees conducted an independent chancellor search. In turn, it forwarded at least two finalists to the UNC system president. The president then chose a final candidate to submit for final approval by the UNC Board of Governors. Hans proposed a change that would have allowed the president to unilaterally up to two hand-chosen candidates to any chancellor search process. Those candidates would go through the same interviews as other candidates, but would automatically move forward in a slate of finalists for the position, irrespective of the opinions of search committees or boards of trustees, in effect. the president would have had the power to appoint the finalist and choose the final candidate from those finalists. The proposed change was unpopular among campus boards of trustees, particularly at HBCUs, that worried the selection of their campus leaders would be further politicized by a board of largely white, largely conservative political appointees. It also divided the UNC's Board of Governors, to which Hans reports. A number of members said they worried it would essentially allow the system to disregard local search committees and boards of trustees. After a long debate, the board changed the proposal so that only one of the president's hand-picked candidates would become an automatic finalist, not two. Even with that amendment, critics said it concentrated too much power in the hands of the UNC system president. Proponents said it made the UNC system more like a private business, in which CEOs choose the leadership teams they believe will be the most successful. Though search processes are confidential, the UNC system said during the time period Hans held that power, he did not use it. Under the new and current policy, Hans still wields a great deal of power in the process, and along with members of the Board of Governors, is more involved from start to finish. Hans, in consultation with the chair of the campus Board of Trustees, chooses the members of the Search Advisory Committee, which must now include members of the Board of Governors. The Advisory Committee will, in partnership with a search firm yet to be chosen, interview candidates and consider community input before sending an unranked list of at least three candidates to the campus Board of Trustees, who will consider those candidates forwarded by the advisory committee and submit three finalists to the system president, who will choose one nominee to present to the Board of Governors. The full board will hold a final vote on the hire. The next in this particular article presents the other 12 members of the NC Central Chancellor Search Committee, Advisory Committee, which I'm not going to read here, but you can find them at IndyWeek.com. That committee will hold a series of listening and input sessions with faculty, staff, and students, and work with Tomika Bowden, president of the North Carolina Central University Alumni Association, to involve alumni in search process, including interviews with finalists, once they are named. Next, over from Raleigh, originally published story on NC Newsline, Raleigh-based Health Center works to reduce rates of black maternal and infant death. This is a center that low-income and uninsured people have relied on for decades. It's opening an OBGYN clinic with the intention of addressing head-on the factors that have black mothers and babies dying at higher rates than white mothers and infants. Services for expectant parents at Advance Community Health will feature a type of group prenatal care that has been credited with reducing rates of preterm births. The center is also starting a parenting program for fathers. Dr. Lisa Vendenland, the director of obstetrics, gynecology, and women's services at Advance, is heading up OBGYN service with a team that includes a nurse, nurse practitioners, a dietitian, and social workers. Offering expansive prenatal services and parent support is a deliberate effort to lower rates of infant and maternal death in communities of color. Vendelin said, these deaths just shouldn't be happening. State healthcare leaders, providers, and community health groups have been talking for years about the state's high infant and maternal mortality rates and how black people are hit the hardest. Reducing infant mortality rates and reducing the gap between black and white survival were some of the reasons behind the early push to expand Medicaid in the state. and North Carolina expanded Medicaid last year. At a celebration at the center's maternity health launch, Advance CEO Scott McRae said starting the service was a goal he set when he had arrived to lead the center 3 years ago. Advance Community Health is one of 42 community health centers in the state aimed at providing care to rural and underserved communities. Community health centers treat patients with and without insurance and offer sliding scale discounts based on income. Advance has offices in Wake and Franklin counties. The Southeast Raleigh headquarters offers the widest array of health services. McRae said he didn't want to start another service, but wanted to build a health care program that would decrease infant mortality in communities of color, have more women of color start prenatal care in their first trimester, reduce instances of low birth weight babies, and tackle high maternal mortality rates. And he said, "We wanted to make sure we're doing something different, something that can make an impact." North Carolina's infant mortality rate improved slightly from 2021 to 22, reported the CDC last year, but black babies here are still more than twice as likely to die before their first birthdays than white babies. The maternal mortality rate in North Carolina more than doubled between 2019 and 21, rising much faster than the national rate. While 22% of North Carolina's population is black, 43% of the women who died from pregnancy-related causes between 2020 and 22 were black, the investigative news site reported. Mothers are more likely to die of a pregnancy-related condition than they were a decade ago, said Dr. Betsy Tilson, State Health Director and Chief Medical Officer at the NC Department of Health and Human Services. Quote, "The tragedy of the infant and maternal deaths is that about 85% of them are preventable. We can prevent those deaths. We can lower the disparity." Black and Latinx women tend to start prenatal care later in their pregnancies than white women. The OBGYN service at Advance will help address problems of access, said Tilson. Central to the effort to improve infant and maternal health will be centering pregnancy, which is a type of group prenatal care that melds checkups with education and discussion groups composed of women with approximately the same due dates. These longer sessions replace the typical 15-minute prenatal checkups. Sarah Horning, a centering pregnancy coordinator, said that centering pregnancy reduces rates of preterm and low-weight births. She said it's not just a prenatal care program. It's creating supportive communities. In the health center's program for fathers called Parenting Papas, men will lead lessons on hands-on baby care. The center will also provide a psychological and social support group for men, Vendelin said. Men who participate in the direct care of their children are more satisfied parents, participating more actively in their communities and raise stronger, healthier kids, she said. By working harder to change maternity care and paternal care, said Vendelin, we can decrease how many moms and babies die. This is our best hope for this program. Now, before we move to cultural mentions in the Indie Week, I can silently hear your pleas from out there in amongst our thousands of listeners. John, what about food-related articles? Come on. Well, we've heard your pleas. It's a short article, but this says four Triangle Chefs and restaurants land James Beard semifinalist nominations. Chini Indian Food Emporium owner Preeti Wass is Best Chef Southeast semifinalist for the second year in a row. Wass, who recently launched a second Cheney location in Durham, told Indy the nomination feels just as surreal as the first time. It's a validation that food and makes people feel good, served with love and intention, is being recognized, she wrote in a text. How about Scott Crawford's flagship restaurant, Crawford & Son, received a semifinalist nomination for the Outstanding Hospitality Award, and Crawford said the acknowledgement is energizing as he prepares to add four new concepts to his restaurant group this year. Quote, while my name is on the door, this recognition is really a tribute to our exceedingly talented team. They're true hospitality professionals who I'm honored to work with every day. The dessert and cocktail lounge, Bittersweet, is the first time semifinalist for Outstanding Bar. Bittersweet has been open for 10 years, just as Durham Alley 26 was when the bar received its first James Beard acknowledgement in 2022. Last but not least, the Mediterranean restaurant, Aja, A-J-J-A, is a semifinalist in the Best New Restaurant category. Ajri owner Chiti Kumar, who formerly helmed Garland Restaurant, has received five semifinalist nominations for Best Chef Southeast in previous years and made it to the final round twice. In 2022, Triangle Chef Ricky Moore, owner of the Salt Box Seafood Joint, won the title instead. Chefs and restaurants in North Carolina received a total of 12 semifinal nominations this year. The Beard Foundation will select finalists in April and announce the winners in June. Now, as time permits, I can embark on a couple of film and recording articles. And the first is most recently written on January 26th about a release from a group called HIO, as in HIO Silver, I guess, H-I-Y-O, on Yep Rock Records from the band called Chatham County Line. Their frankly titled fourth album, which was called F-I-V, four, and HIO, the trio soon to release 10th album, recorded about a decade and a half apart in the same place, Asheville's Echo Mountain Studio. That studio, a converted Methodist sanctuary, has become a recording destination for adventurous acts of a variety of stripes. Steve Martin, the Avett Brothers, Sylvan Esso. At the time that the decidedly bluegrass band, then consisting of guitarist and lead singer Dave Wilson, mandolin John Teer, bass pedal steel player Greg Redding, and banjo Chandler Holt recorded IV, though Echo Mountain had only been open a couple of years. Wilson recalls, it was clean, brand new. The intervening years have worn the space, he muses, but they've also given it an ineffable something it didn't have before. Quote, it felt so cool to go back all these years later and the stairs are all scratched up and there's dust bunnies in the corner. It's just like, oh man, this place has got the mojo now. I mean, it had it back then, but it really is lived in now and it's been vibrated. Time has also worn and reshaped Chatham County Line, and like Echo Mountain, they're all the better for it. Born in 1999, following the dissolution of Redding and Wilson's previous Raleigh folk rock band, Stillhouse, the group progressed through three straightforward and increasingly pristine bluegrass albums on their way to IV. Through the years and albums that followed after, the group increasingly clawed at the strict confines of traditional bluegrass instrumentation. They were already doing it, really, expertly laying in Redding's dreamy pedal steel. But subsequent albums saw the band add drums, an accompaniment often seen as a cardinal sin amongst bluegrass purists, and piano, stepping beyond the style's rigid structures. a rebellious rock and roll spirit has long defined Chatham County Line, as evidenced by the fully electrified holiday tours the group went on annually, even as they continued to famously play and sing live around a single microphone the rest of the year. That mojo is fully realized on Hi-Yo, a warmly futuristic vision of what old-time leaning folk can be in 2024. It's marked not just by earnest and energetic picking and singing, but by synthesizers and drum machines and the sumptuously reverberating production aesthetic of Rachel Moore, a close T-Bone Burnett collaborator. This is all a stunning, but not altogether unexpected, evolution for the band, an affirmation of the freedom they've been seeking since they crystallized their acoustic prowess on that first trip to Echo Mountain. Chatham County isn't the only group pushing the frontiers of bluegrass. Wilson says, once folks like Sagegrass phenomena, Billy Strings, began to be accepted into the genre, the landscape felt wide open, and fellow Tar Heel luminaries, Steep Canyon Rangers, are as much an Americana act these days as they are a bluegrass band. And Wilson says of the feeling he gets from some of his all-time favorite albums, it's kind of when they quit caring about what other people thought and made an album really to move themselves. That's kind of the moment that always makes a special record, I've found. And this album, I don't know how to describe it. It was like we just didn't care anymore. One of Chatham County Line's tethers to bluegrass was Holt's banjo, the driving engine of the group during its more traditional days. In 2020, Holt stepped away from the band after two decades to spend more time with family. An electrifying picker, his presence never held the band back, but his instrument remained the backbone of their sound. Wilson explains, we were sort of beholden to a certain style, being all acoustic and using the banjo. Dropping that instrument, it just kicks open the door wide to a whole new world and a whole new way to live. The pandemic, while certainly unwelcome, became an opportunity to gestate budding notions of what the band could become. Wilson, shaken by a time that was, quote, so freaking weird and negative, stalled in his concerted songwriting, instead randomly recording and writing down snippets of ideas, a process he compares to Jackson Browne's famous penchant for calling his answering machine to get down emerging inspirations. Building up a new live version of the group was another crucial step as pedals and effects and amps became ingrained elements. Wilson started tuning his guitar to an open G, the way Keith Richards does, mimicking the traditional tuning of a banjo. Another essential piece of the puzzle was delivered when Chatham County Line was cast to play members of the band backing George Jones and Tammy Wynette on George and Tammy, the Showtime series starring Jessica Chastain and Michael Shannon, which began filming in late 2021. It was there that they met Moore, who helped T-Bone Burnett with the show's music, connecting them with a producer with a forward-looking vision to help the band realize its evolution. The resulting collection is beautifully ethereal and wistful. The songs fixate on the beginnings and endings of relationships, inspired in part by the band's own time of transition, but they keep an eye glued, hopefully, to the unreachable horizon. The accompanying music is both distinct and distinctly modern. Lead-off song and lead single Right on Time praises a woman who was right on time to take my mind and start it over, as echoing electric guitar and bass fiddle and drums bound through a widescreen folk rock vista with an old-time heart and futuristic sparkle. On Magic, angelic electronic chirps and steady drums reinforce giddily looping acoustic picking as Wilson opines, the night is young and the feeling's right. I got a little buzz, but baby, that's all right. Enraptured by a budding romance. The Lone Ranger brings ghostly electric blues that echo from beyond the veil, bolstering them with soothing acoustic drone, a transfixing and effective curveball. Balancing his anxiety about spending just one night with a woman, Wilson looks backward and forward. Quote, as a boy, I lived for television on Saturdays, cartoons, cowboys showing me the way. I still check under, getting bed most nights. Made mistakes, but I was brought up right. The album's lone instrumental, the elegiacally loping old-time interlude, Way Down Yonder, serves as a firm assurance that this is still Chatham County line. They've simply left behind constraints that no longer feel important. All right, a film review that I've put off for a little bit. It may have been out for a while. Freud's Last Session, reviewed here in Indy and given 3 out of 4 stars. Two great thinkers square off. Freud's last season, the talkie and cerebral UK film in theaters this week, is the kind of movie we don't see much anymore. Adapted from a stage play, it's a movie about two people talking. In this case, two of the greatest thinkers of the 20th century. The setup is intriguing. Set in the anxious days before World War II, the script imagines an extended London encounter between world-famous neurologist Sigmund Freud, Anthony Hopkins, and author C.S. Lewis, Matthew Good, the Oxford scholar and theologian who gave us the Chronicles of Narnia. Did this auspicious summit actually take place? Probably not, but maybe. Historians tell us that Freud did indeed meet with a, quote, famed Oxford don around this time in his London home. It's a delicious slice of conjecture. Lewis was at the time the world's most famous Christian thinker and apologist, which in this context just means an advocate and public defender. Freud, of course, was an avowed atheist, man of science, and the father of psychoanalysis. He tells Lewis in the film, I'm a passionate disbeliever who is obsessed with ancient belief, yours included. As you might imagine, it's a pretty good discussion. Freud and Lewis cover a lot of ground. God, death, free will, sex, despair, fathers, daughters, war, morphine, dental prostheses, and, of course, cigars. Freud calls Christianity a ludicrous dream, an insidious lie. Lewis stands his ground. You don't have to be an imbecile to believe in God, he says. Those of us who do are not suffering from an obsessional neurosis. The film is strictly even-handed and gives each man's perspective equal time and rhetorical weight. The dialogue is heightened, and screenwriter Marc St. Germain's use of language is gorgeous. Meanwhile, director Matthew Brown stitches in some new threads to open up the stagey nature of the script. It's still pretty stagey. Freud, we learn, is suffering from terminal oral cancer and some deep regrets, explored in dream sequences and flashbacks. When air raid sirens send the pair to a nearby church cellar, another brutal flashback sequence explores Lewis's lingering trauma from World War I. The most compelling subplot involves Freud's adult daughter Anna, a fierce thinker in her own right who would go on to pioneer the field of child psychoanalysis. In this film, Freud treats her cruelly, even as she tries to care for him in his final weeks. As Anna, the German actress Liv Lisa Fries very nearly steals the film, and I was surprised to find I wanted the story to follow her up and out of that grim London mansion. The rolling conversation between the men is never less than engaging, and Hopkins holds the frame effortlessly, as always, with those ancient Welsh eyes, but Anna is the character I really cared about in the end. Freud's last session is effective as a kind of staged thought experiment, but as a film, it never really finds its groove. The visuals are muddy and sometimes gaudy, those dream sequences. And the intrusive musical score is a sustained bummer. Still, it's a great opportunity for that noble ritual of after-movie debate. Why not keep the discussion going? After all, the film raises questions at the very core of the human condition. Those who value the art of good conversation will appreciate the film, I think. You can get to places in dialogue that you just can't get into in your own head. The best exchange comes near the end. Freud says, "It was madness to think we could explain the greatest mystery of all time." Lewis replies, "No, there's greater madness not to think of it." Well, there's a bit of a whimsical article in this issue about journalism in particular, or I mean in general, and student journalism in particular, and student journalist basketball teams even more particular. Media may be in crisis, but on the court, rival student journalists keep it lively. On February the 3rd, the towering Titans of Duke and UNC Chapel Hill men's basketball will battle for glory in the latest game of the Tobacco Road rivalry. A week before that matchup, though, that already happened, the student journalists at those schools put down their pens and took to the courts of Duke's Brody Gym for the third annual basketball game. The student journalists may have been shorter and less athletic than their Division I counterparts, but they played with a ferocity befitting of their high aspiration. The game kicked off the annual week-long fundraising challenge between the two newspapers. DTH general manager Courtney Mitchell says, "Neither the Daily Tar Heel nor the Chronicle receive any funding from the universities. Typically, in years past, papers were full of advertising, and newspaper organizations were flush. In the last 10 years, we've seen that advertising decline and continue to decline." The rivalry challenge is an attempt to turn some bad blue blood into something constructive. Together, the papers raised more than $84,000 last year. The Chronicle has won the fundraising challenge for the past 3 years, although the Daily Tar Heel won last year's basketball game. DTH sports editor Shelby Swanson says the Chronicle staff tend to come in at the last minute with all these big-wig, big-time donors, so we're looking for the more grassroots approach. The two publications have each gained national attention in recent years, although not for the staff's basketball skills. In 22, the Chronicle broke the news that Duke's student graduation speaker lifted part of her speech from a Harvard address. Last year, DTH coverage of a lockdown during a UNC shooting went viral and scored a retweet from President Biden. Both papers track important news and cultural developments both on and off their respective campuses. Journalism at large is a pretty bleak field right now. News corporations are cutting costs by shuttering publications, while independent papers are buckling under financial pressure, leaving news deserts and reporting voids across the country. A report from Northwestern University found, quote, since 2005, the U.S. has lost nearly 2,900 newspapers and 43,000 journalists. Last week, Axios reported on the latest bloodbath of layoffs at Pitchfork, the Los Angeles Times, and Sports Illustrated. Emmy Martin, editor of the Daily Tar Heel, said, "Journalism and just news in general is in a crisis. for right now, student journalists are stepping up, and I think we'll continue to step up. Student journalism is filling in the gaps of local news. At a local level, journalism programs at these local colleges serve as a pipeline for staff at publications like the News and Observer, Chapelboro, and of course, the Indy. Journalism aside, for Chronicle sophomore Rajan Jindal, the basketball game was a chance at redemption. Last year, victory was almost in Duke's grasp when the unthinkable happened. Both my legs cramped, Jindal tells the Indy during warm-ups. I guess I just wasn't eating my potassium or whatever. Several team members confirmed that Jindal's downfall cost them last year's trophy, although there isn't a real trophy. On the other side of the court, Swanson fondly remembered the cramping incident. She says, we're coming off a solid win last year, and we're going to look to carry that momentum into this matchup. Now, Jindal was in Duke's starting lineup this year as the publications played best of 3 to 25 points. A missed three-pointer in the first few minutes of the game made it look like Jindal was losing the battle against the Heels and perhaps his own demons. Soon, though, he regained the ball for a layup, drawing first blood and kicking off an early scoring run for the Blue Devils and leading them to victory in the first game. Duke, making use of their home field advantage, brought out their mascot, who pranced around, taunting the Tar Heels with Beat DTH taped to his forehead. The Tar Heels retaliated with a full-throated Let's Go Tar Heels chants and various accusations of airball when the Devils just couldn't find the hoop. Early in the second game, the Chronicles' Dom Finoglio tumbled headfirst into a concrete wall. He was escorted out of the gym, blood smeared across his white Beat DTH t-shirt, but the fallen assistant editor soon lumbered back in, holding an ice pack to his scalp. The only thing on his mind, besides maybe a concussion, was victory. If we win, anything's worth it, Finoglio told Indy, while two Blue Polo Duke employees, armed with the biohazard cleanup kit, put caution, wet floor signs up around his bloody splash zone. And I haven't consciously left it this way, but I will not be able to reveal the exciting conclusion to this series of three short basketball games. You'll have to go to IndyWeek.com and read all about it if you would want to. And John Federson will say goodbye now from the North Carolina Reading Service with Indy Week, and we'll be back next week with a brand new issue.